Well, good morning, everybody, and welcome. Welcome to Essex Church, where this community of Kensington Unitarians meets for worship each Sunday morning. I realise that I often use the word turmoil to describe either what's going on in our society or with our weather, and then correlate the two. And it has been so very changeable, hasn't it? There are so many difficult pieces of news to deal with in our world, and there are so many joyous, inspiring stories too. I think of the weather this week, from wild and windy to strangely mild, sunny and icy. And I hope that perhaps here we can find some kind of balance, whatever the turbulence we might be experiencing in life. A place of inner peace, perhaps, to a rock maybe on which we can find our spiritual feet, and a sense of community that can hold us firm however fiercely the winds blow, and a chance to remember perhaps once again our connection, be that with God, with spirit, whatever word you might use for the divine, or with the very human spirit that shines within us all. From the love and the commitment that I think can come from relating well one with another. So I invite you to take a moment now to center yourself, to settle, as it were, into ourselves and into this gathered community here today, as we consider that this is a day of promise. A day in which life will ever assert itself in the beauty of the natural world, with its fresh air and presently clear skies. This is a day of potential and promise. May we rejoice and be glad of that. And I'm lighting our chalice this morning, this symbol of our Unitarian community the world over, that it might remind us in the oneness of its flame, that it might remind us of our shared humanity. Welcome, all of you. I call on the divine spirit of life and of love to be with us now in this time of shared worship, and to bless all that we say and do here together today. As we look back over the week that has passed, if we are human, it's likely that then we will have some awareness of the times when we fell short in some way, when we perhaps allowed ourselves to be diminished, perhaps by harsh words or more likely harsh thoughts, by failing to act perhaps, or perhaps by acting too hastily. Let us think kindly of ourselves. And if we are human, well, we may be aware of the failings of others. We may well have been let down in some way, or hurt, or harmed. May we find the gracious gift of forgiveness if it is time to do so. We may have been frightened, or angered, or frustrated by life. May the gentle flowing waters of the Spirit allow us to let go of that which is ready to be released. And may the light of understanding shine upon our situations in life, so that we might be better able to understand what is needed from us at this time. And if we are human, it is likely that we are sometimes consumed with care and concern for others. In a short time of stillness now, let's send our thoughts and prayers to people or to places where there is suffering, that they might know our love. And so may we live this day compassionate of heart, clear in word, gracious in our understanding of the limitations of our powers, yet still courageous in thought, and generous in action. Amen. This reading stems partly from our Embracing the Shadow workshop yesterday. It's written by Leah Perlman, who worked with Facebook and then went on to found an Institute of Happiness in California. There should be an Institute of Happiness in California, shouldn't there? Can you love the one who... There's one in you who's sweet and there's one in you who's mean. Can you love them both? Can you let them both be seen?
Can you love the one who tries and love her when she fails? Can you love the one who lies and love the one who wails?
Can you love your tears? Can you love your worry? Can you love your darkest fears? And can you love your fury?
Can you love indifference? Love the one who clings? Can you love the vibrant one? Love the one who sings.
Can you love your addict? Can you love your thief? Can you love your vanity? And can you love your grief?
Can you love your inner child and your body as you age? Can you love your wild side? Release her from her cage. Can you love the one fulfilled and the one who is not?
Can you love the one who's chilled and whose temper's hot? Can you love the weakling, the one who's sometimes sick? Can you love the warrior who fights through thin and thick?
Can you love your crazy? Can you love your sane? Can you love your foolish heart? Love your scattered brain?
There's one in you who's bored and one who's often stressed. Can you love them both at once and he who tries his best?
And if the answer's no to some of the above, then can you love the one in you who's learning how to love?
Thank you, Sonia. Carol, it was you that gave me this a number of years ago. Derek Walcott's poem, Love After Love. The time will come when with elation you will greet yourself arriving at your own door, in your own mirror, and each will smile at the other's welcome and say, sit here, eat. You will love again the stranger who was yourself. Give wine, give bread, give back your heart to itself, to the stranger who has loved you all your life, whom you ignored for another, who knows you by heart. Take down the love letters from the bookshelf, the photographs, the desperate notes. Peel your own image from the mirror. Sit, feast on your life. Love After Love by Derek Walcott. Have you heard of a project called Letters of Note? Oh, I love introducing people to new things like this. Okay, this is now published as a book by Sean Usher, but it started life as an internet collection of in quotations, correspondence deserving of a wider audience. It is a really lovely idea. And when you go on that website, you find some really special letters from famous people, often in their original form, and then they're transcribed afterwards. And I went to this website to collect, to check the quotation that I wanted to start this address with. Aldous Huxley, writer and philosopher, did indeed say in his last few days, and he said a number of other really interesting things. It is, he said, a bit embarrassing to have been concerned with the human problem all one's life and find at the end that one has no more to offer by way of advice than try to be a little kinder. And that's what this address is all about. The value of us trying to be a little kinder, starting with ourselves. Kindness and compassion could be described as core human values that help form the moral foundation of human relationships and human society. And I'm going to explore today the idea that if we discover in ourselves a lack of self-compassion, then there's vital repair work to be done. Because if we can't be kind to ourselves, then how can we hope to create a truly compassionate society? And even if we are ourselves radiant examples of self-compassion, then we just need to turn our attention to those around us, because I believe we live in a world that is shaped and distorted by damaging self-criticism. It is not easy to probe into each other's minds, is it? So I don't know if all of us have this inner judging dialogue running through much of the day. But over the years, I've heard enough from others to suspect that there is a lot of it about. I remember being with a friend in her car when she reversed into a lamppost. It was a minor bump, very minor bump. We, the car and the lamppost, all lived to tell the tale. But what we talked about most afterwards was her reaction, because at the moment of the impact, the harsh words, "Oh, you stupid woman," came out of her mouth. And she remembered later how often she'd heard her mother say a similar thing. And we wondered where her mother had learnt to speak so harshly to herself, and what effect that must have had on her life, but of course on the next generation's life as well. Working with troubled teenagers years ago, I came to realise that beneath the bravado of some of those youngsters, and it was often the ones who behaved the most badly, there was a terrible sense of their own unworthiness. Deep inside, they were deeply ashamed of themselves and their behaviour. Deep inside, they regarded themselves as worthless. And at that time, we started to work with what was then called self-esteem, encouraging them to think more highly of themselves and to build up more positive self-images. But looking back, I'm not sure how successful we were. Because one of the problems about people's lack of self-compassion is just how deep its origins lie. Another friend spoke to me recently about a biblical passage that has stayed with her since childhood. It's the origin of this saying, "the writing on the wall," meaning that a doom-laden future is foretold and cannot be escaped from. I don't know if you know the story. I did not. So it takes place when the Jews have been captured by the Babylonians. They've been taken into exile, and at a drunken feast, the Babylonian ruler, Belshazzar, commits the terrible sin of using the stolen sacred cups from the temple in Jerusalem to drink alcohol from. In the midst of the party, and this would be a downer on any party, wouldn't it? A disembodied finger appears. Keep your eyes on the walls, everybody, for the rest of this service. A disembodied finger appears and writes on the wall, but nobody knows what it can say until they call on Daniel, a most righteous man, who interprets the writing as saying, "weighed and found wanting." Belshazzar has been judged by God and indeed found wanting, not up to the mark. But how often do we judge ourselves harshly and find ourselves wanting for, I suspect, far more minor misdemeanors in life? How often do we act as both judge and jury in our own lives? I found a moving passage written by a Canadian priest who I really respect, Henri Nguyen. And he writes, "Over the years, I've come to realise that the greatest trap in life, in our life, is not success, popularity or power, but self-rejection. Success, popularity and power can indeed present a great temptation," he writes, "but their seductive quality often comes from the way they are part of the much larger temptation to self-rejection. When we have come to believe in the voices that call us worthless and unlovable, then success, popularity and power are easily perceived as attractive solutions. The real trap is self-rejection. As soon as someone accuses me or criticizes me," Nguyen writes, "as soon as I am rejected, left alone or abandoned, I find myself thinking, well, that proves once again, doesn't it, that I am a nobody. I'm no good. I deserve to be pushed aside, forgotten, rejected, and abandoned." Self-rejection, he writes, is the greatest enemy of the spiritual life because it contradicts the sacred voice that calls us the beloved. And being the beloved constitutes the core truth of our existence. I find that incredibly moving, really, that idea that we cannot look upon ourselves with loving eyes. How can then we learn to look upon ourselves with those eyes of love that Derek Walcott was describing in that poem, Love After Love, when he writes that the time will come when, with elation, you will greet yourself arriving at your own door in your own mirror, and each will smile at the other's welcome. Last autumn, I had the good fortune to spend a day at a conference on compassion and empathy in society here in London. There were many good things about this conference, including the snacks, which I thought were really above average. Nice bits of fruit on a stick instead of crummy biscuits. But really, I think the thing that I want to say that I find the best about this conference was that all of their material is now available, freely available on the internet. And I've printed out at the back, if you want to take away with you later, the website details about this day. So the day was introduced by Karen Armstrong, whose book, 12 Steps to a Compassionate Life, we studied here at Essex Church a couple of years ago. And one of the steps in that book is compassion for yourself. That chapter starts with a moving story of Rabbi Albert Friedlander, who explained the importance of the biblical injunction, love your neighbour as yourself, first found in the book of Leviticus. He emphasised the importance of the second part of that statement, as yourself, because if you cannot love yourself, you cannot love others. As a child in Nazi Germany, as a Jewish child in Nazi Germany, he was terribly affected by the anti-Semitism that surrounded him. And one night he lay in bed and started to list all his good qualities, and he vowed to use those qualities to help create a better world and to counteract the hideously damaging message that he was hearing at that time. Now, in recent years, developments in neuroscience have helped us to understand more about how our brains work. When we are judging ourselves or others harshly, there is an ancient reptilian part of our brain being activated, the amygdala. It deals with the most basic of responses, which is what gets us to survive. Now, the more that we can temper that kind of quick, harsh kind of survival response with a more measured, thoughtful, reflective response that needs to be based up here in our prefrontal cortex, then apparently the more compassionate we can become. Up at the University of Derby, a professor, Paul Gilbert, is working on what he calls compassion-focused therapy, having long studied the negative effects of shame. Increasingly, I think we are coming to understand that being ashamed of our behaviour does not actually always encourage us to behave better. It can oftentimes make us feel worse, and that can have an almost brutalising effect on us. I know a number of us were really disturbed by the story in the news this week in Britain where three care workers were jailed for gratuitously tormenting patients with dementia. And I think it's one of the things that reflective people have to reflect upon is, well, how do people do these things? What do they feel about themselves when they are doing such terrible things? I think really throughout the National Health Service at the moment, there is a growing concern that greater compassion needs to be encouraged in patient care. The other speaker at the conference who impressed me was Professor Kristin Neff, who has created an excellent website on self-compassion, complete with a test for you to find out just how self-compassionate you truly are. I hope you'll all go home and give that a go later on. Her website is a complete gift to humanity. It's full of exercises and all sorts of really very inspiring pieces of material. She writes about the importance of self-kindness, but she balances that with a really important realization that to be self-compassionate is to show an understanding that we are in some way all in this together, that our struggles are part of our common humanity. And she also emphasizes the Buddhist tradition of mindfulness, developing a kindly, ongoing awareness of what is actually going on in our heads, the quality of our self-talk, as it's sometimes called. And she reminds us that self-compassion is not self-pity, nor is it self-indulgence. It's a very healthy way to be. I already knew Kristin Neff's name because she is a mother to a severely autistic child whose life-changing journey to Mongolia is written about in a very loving book and a film now called The Horse Boy. At the conference, she told us a story of being on a long-distance flight with her four-year-old autistic child who was screaming, as young children can do. I think only possibly a childcare worker or a parent would understand the unbearableness at times of dealing with a screaming child. And the difference between a two-year-old and a four-year-old. People can be remarkably compassionate about a two-year-old having a tantrum, but this was quite a big four-year-old, and she was becoming more and more distressed, trying to calm him down to no avail. She described in the end deciding that she would head towards the bathroom, trying to get him out of his seat at least. And she's there walking down the aisle of the plane. The child is screaming. She gets to the bathroom and, of course, there's somebody in there already. So she's now in a very cramped little vestibule. The child is still screaming and kicking. And at that point, she realised that actually her negative self-talk, which was going along the lines of, oh my goodness, what are people thinking of me? Why can't I control my child? This is unbearable. It was that she had to alter. And in those moments where she turned her attention to herself and started to say kindly things to herself, that her child started to calm down too. Because, of course, we affect one another. Within this story, I think, is an important lesson for me and perhaps for us all. Just as Kristin at that moment was unable to do anything to actually soothe her troubled child, so we in life, I think, need to understand the limits of our powers. We're not as in charge of most things in life as we would oftentimes like to be. We are frail, wounded, imperfect beings living less than perfect lives in a really very less than perfect world. But what I think each of us can do is to strengthen our relationship with ourselves through loving compassion and acceptance of how we are and who we are. And knowing that we are all in this together, perhaps then we'll all benefit from being just a little kinder to ourselves. Amen. And to close, a Tibetan Buddhist prayer. May you be at peace. May your heart remain open. May you awaken to the light of your true nature. May you be healed. May you be a source of healing for all beings. And may you know the love and acceptance that is there for us all. Amen.